This podcast is part of the Deluxe Edition Network. To find other great shows on the network, head over to deluxeeditionnetwork.com. That's deluxeeditionnetwork.com.
Coffee-fueled story.
Hello, hello, hello. You're listening to Coffee Fueled Stories. I'm your host, Michelle, your pocket DJ, and we are chatting with Jessica Grew Glover. Hello, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me again.
This is awesome. Three Peter of the podcast. This is your third. Well, we did a very long chat that we broke into two sections because you had your second book coming out, and now you have Stars Like Gasoline that we're going to talk about today.
Yay!
Yes! I would love to know about the title before we go any further, because Stars Like Gasoline, that's just a really cool title. And so I'm just like really curious to know, like, where did that come from?
So there's a little bit of spoiling, and it's not even technically storing. It's spoiling. It's just kind of a line towards the end of the book that kind of, oh, but the whole gist of it is that it's kind of like the combustibility of life and love and relationships, like romantic, familial, everything. Like Stars Like Gasoline's very strong familial relationships. And there's also a lot of nods to kind of Victor Hugo, and he does a lot of different quotes having to do with the stars, and so it kind of feeds into that and the combustibility. And then there's also like slipping in, you can probably find it on the playlist for the book, there's a song by my favorite band that's titled Gasoline. And so it's just kind of a nod to everything. Victor Hugo, it's, you know, the band, it's a line that Adrian says, it's a line that Oscar says, Nate says, it's just kind of everything. So
I knew that there would be like some really cool story behind it. And I didn't want to take the words out of the author's mouth, because that's what you're here for. That's we're going to talk about this. I want to get silly with this, if you're okay with that.
Absolutely.
Okay. And, or maybe it's just my curiosity. Maybe it's not just silly. It's just my curiosity. On page 13, the main character, Celia, she grabs a Cabernet and a book.
Okay.
But you don't say what book.
I don't say what book. This has bothered me the whole time.
Oh, no.
I knew there would be somebody who asked, and I was like, oh, I don't say what book.
I was like, did she intentionally do that so that we could like think? You tell us.
No. Tell me what in your book, because I'm really curious.
Okay. So first off, Cabernet. So I'm thinking nice, delicious, red, full-bodied. So right there, my senses are already awakened. And then this is the silly part, the curiosity. I'm like, okay, is it a goblet or is it a stemless glass? Ooh. I'm trying to think of what, to her, wine isn't just wine.
Yeah.
And, at least in my mind. And so I was like, okay, I have a feeling. I just see a big goblet and she has the stem in between her fingers so that she can carry the book so that she's not having like an awkwardness with the book. And this is so silly. And I think it's because Moby Dick is like, randomly, I keep seeing Moby Dick for some reason. And I was like, would she be reading something Melville? Or would she be reading something French? And I was like, knowing her, it's going to be some French poetry. Baudelaire, is that how you say the name?
Yeah.
So I thought, you know, I was like, is it going to be classic American? Or is it going to be French? And I was like, it's a cab and it's French poetry.
So I have a couple answers. Okay. One, I think in an early version of Stars, because the beginning changed so much, like maybe four or five times, to the point where my husband actually hasn't read this version of the book yet, because he read such an early version. He's like, oh yeah, it begins. And I'm like, yeah, no, that was cut like 2 years ago. but I think I described it as a cut glass goblet. I have these wine glasses that my mother-in-law had gotten us, I think when we were first married, by a glass factory in the south of France called Biot. And we actually visited, it was when my daughter was two. She's 19 now. So a long time ago, we visited the factory. We watched them actually blowing all of the glass. So cool. But what's different about all the Biot glasses is that most of them come in colors, not all of them, because we had some bowls that were clear as well, but all the ones that we had are colorful. And so it's like a big goblet of a wine glass. And I think we only have like four surviving now, which is unfortunate, but they have all the bubbles in them as well. Oh. So it's purposeful. So in my mind, it was a glass like that, where it was kind of cut glass with the bubbles, and probably a shade that went with how she was redoing her house. Like maybe something that you would pick up at a museum gift store.
Very cool.
And then I toyed with the idea in the beginning of her reading Voltaire, which I thought would be kind of funny.
Yeah.
And then in my mind, I was like, you know what she would read? And it was the Goldfinch. So I saw it as the Goldfinch with this like bubbled wine glass.
Oh man, I was way off.
So I mean, not way off, because there was Voltaire there. So I mean, it could have been. It was one of those things that was playing around in my mind. But yeah, so.
That's awesome. You also kind of, I didn't mark the page, but shoot, and I forget. It was she reaches for something. It's very early on in the book. She reaches for something, and there was a perfume bottle. Was it the holy water? She reached for something, and it said perfume, and I was trying to imagine what perfume it would be on in this little area. And what's interesting is a few pages later, you mentioned Chanel number 5. And so I was like, okay, because in my mind, same thing. I was thinking, okay, it's going to be something classic. It's going to be something timeless. And you can never go wrong with Chanel number 5.
Yeah. And then it's what she gives her away love for Christmas a few years ago. So that's the, yeah.
Yes. Yes. Very cool. You mentioned coffee on page 17. It's where she's having coffee and in the middle of the night. We see how he takes his, right? Was it Tycho?
Adrian.
Adrian, sorry. I was trying to imagine how she takes her coffee, and I don't. And so I apologize if you actually do say it.
I don't think I do there. She takes it usually just with cream. But when she orders a latte, she orders a coconut latte. It's just the way it goes.
That's right. That's right. And then I was also thinking, because of their location, they're in Florida. And so I was thinking, what if it was a cafecito? You know, the Cuban coffee, because, yeah. I mean, that's just...
I grew up on that, yeah.
I know. And so I kind of nerd. I was like, coffee? Was it coffee or was it cafecito? Let's kind of like dive into the book. I love how you tap into the Latin. I'm just going to use Latin as a general term. What is it about Latin culture and apparitions?
Yeah.
They're like ingrained, you know? They're just infused.
Absolutely.
And so,
I mean, I think that's where, you know, we call it all speculative and paranormal, because we live in, you know, this reality-based genre. You know, that's kind of where we live in, if we're putting ourselves in a box. And it really is just a box. But a lot of, I would say Latin American literature, more so. I haven't read as much. I'm like thinking as I speak, sorry. Read as much that would be necessarily, apart from like Zafón, which he's Spanish. But apart from that, I think I haven't read a lot of actual like Spanish from Spain literature. A lot was Latin American. I took a Gabriel Garcia Marquez, two classes actually in university, and one that was a William Faulkner and Garcia Marquez like comparative literature class, which I think nearly killed me.
Okay, that would be a podcast episode all in itself, because I would just pluck your brain on that. I would be like, give me talk, let's go, nerd out.
That was the deepest, I think that was literally the deepest dive class I've taken out of everything. Every theoretical class that I took, that was a deep one. But getting back to it, I think that a lot of the Latin American literature, it's magical realism, which is a genre that we don't attribute to English language literature, because of that inherent existence of magic, I'm air quoting, magic or the speculative in everyday life, which is, you know, religion as well. you know, yes. It all feeds into each other. So mm-hmm. I think that's mm-hmm. why the apparitions are always there. I mean, we, you know, as I say we, as I'm a terrible Catholic, but like, as, you know, as Catholics or, I mean, we, and that's my foreword, is that we actually yes. consume yes. the body and blood of Christ every Sunday morning or, you know, midnight mass, whatever you go to. I mean, if that's not speculative, I don't know what is.
So therein lies that connection. So thank you for that, because I love magical realism. It is one of my favorite genres. And it all started with reading House of the Spirits. My mom, like I said, she was from born and raised in Argentina. And I'm reading the story of House of the Spirits, and I'm envisioning my family, like my great grandmother mm-hmm. and my grandmother. There's a certain kind of music that comes from that region, chamamé. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother used to listen to it all the time. And so when my mom was still alive, she and I were like talking about our DNA and how we, like, you can literally see like where the family comes from, that you can map it. And so when my mom was telling me all of this, I just really felt so connected to that genre. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I could relate to my family, like my roots, like my blood.
That's so cool. Isn't that amazing? Ugh.
Right? Like, I just don't get that. Like, I don't get me wrong. I love my horror books. I love that.
Yeah.
But there's something about that magical realism. And yeah. I guess because I have the background, it kind of does make sense. But, and same thing, I've never read anything from Spain, true Spanish, even though I have relatives from Spain. And someday I hope to go to Spain. I hope so. I love your photos from Spain. Like, you had some amazing, I'm just like, I feel like I get to live through you, because I'm like, maybe I'll go there. Until then, I'm just
pretty amazing.
Oh my God. So do you travel for like research, or do you, as you're someplace that you're traveling and experiencing, you're like, you know what? I think this would make a great story.
Yeah, probably. I mean, I guess a little bit of both. I don't necessarily set out to travel for research because I can't afford it. I mean, if I could, I would absolutely be like, you know what we're going to do next week? Like, totally all over that. But I do, it's funny, I wrote an article, Agora for Writers, I think. It was a little article on traveling and writing. And I always think I'm going to write while I'm traveling, and I never do. But what I do is I stockpile ideas, and I write notes, and I think about it, and like kind of earmark songs and things like that, that put me back into the feels. And so like when we were in Barcelona and we were in La Costa Brava, I had so many ideas from the book that I'm currently writing, and for a possible fourth book in the Beast series, and I want it to take place in that region, so like the northern part of Spain. So I was definitely kind of churning ideas. And then for Beast, I mean, there's a lot of travel, and we talked about that in our previous podcast. And then the area there, the town was a town called Castlecombe in the Cotswolds, and that's what I based Barlowcombe on, but the cottage was based on my mother-in-law's old 16th century cottage. So it's kind of, I just stockpile things, and then I'm a deep dive researcher, and it's one of my favorite things to do. Like, I go down rabbit holes, and I get lost in research. It's not best. And Stars Like Gasoline, my mom lives in Vero, and so, you know, I've spent, I don't know, you know, half of the last 15 years there. So I'm from South Florida anyway, but she had moved up to Vero, and I loved Vero. You know, all things aside, what's going on in Florida right now, but you know, like,
yeah.
But I do love Vero Beach, and there's so much there that I just wanted to show in this book. And so it was like the natural setting for it.
Especially because Boston, right? She was in Boston. Mm-hmm. And Boston, if you think about, like, Boston and Florida are like such a contrast, you know?
Oh yeah.
You know, so she has that experience, and now she's down in Florida, even though, you know, she grew up there. She has this, how much of her heart is still left in the city, Boston? And so even though we have these places that we grow up with her, I felt like there was this, I don't want to use the word torn, but she kind of had like, she had to figure out like where she fit. I know that, I don't know if that sounds silly, but, and I could be completely overthinking the character. Which
no,
was not.
I, no, I think you're right. I mean, I think you're right, is she was trying to find her way. Because, I mean, you know, there's that saying, you can't go home again. And I think that was probably part of her fear. She was forging her career in Boston after she went to school there. And she was doing well, assistant museum curator. And, you know, all the while, she's missing her brother. I mean, she and Oscar are tight.
Yeah.
And he goes through this horrendous tragedy.
Yeah.
And she can't get home again. Yeah. And I think that just wears on her for so long until she sees the listing of the house. And that's when she's like, I need to be there. And so then it's finding where she fits in back home, because she has had this experience of living in a city, and now she's back in a small town. Vero's a small town. Everybody knows each other, kind of, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, there's that. And you know, as we get further along into the book, she kind of feels like, I had one beta reader who suggested I take out the section on St. Augustine. And it was just one. And then I presented the idea to quite a few other people in my writing group, and everyone was like, absolutely not. And I was so glad, because I felt like this is where she disassociates. You know, she's going through a lot. She's been through a lot at this point, without spoilers, but this is where she needs to disassociate. She's been betrayed by her home and everybody in it, and she needs to cut ties for a bit. So I felt that was necessary. And true to the character, she needed to be able to figure out where she belongs, because she's somebody she's not going to ride someone else's coattails. She's not going to follow. She's doing it her way, or she's leaving. So,
yeah. Yeah. So you said you had some beta readers. Do you have like certain people that you choose to do as betas? Like, do you think to yourself, okay, I want my friend so-and-so to beta read, I want so-and-so to beta read, or do you have like a beta team, so to speak?
I've kind of had both. With this book, it went through so many people, from, you know, like kind of my best friend, actually one of my best friends got it and my mom did in piecemeal, chapter by chapter, as I wrote it, completely unedited. And they're like, where's that next one? And then I wanted to do PitMed with it, which I did. This is quite a few years ago. And I had just met my friend Becca, who's no longer on Instagram, but she and I talk all the time. And she's one of my critique partners now. And I had just met her on Instagram, and I was like, hey, do you feel like listening to a couple of my tweet pitches? She's like, sure, send it to me. And then she was like, and send me the book. And so now she gets everything. And then I would put out a call for betas, and put out a call for ARC readers. And I just, you know, it went through a writing group. Goodness, I think this book went through maybe 15 people.
Wow.
Before it was finally edited and, like, I mean, you know, the final big edit and published. So yeah, it went through a lot of people, including a couple sensitivity reads for various issues. Yeah. And then I had the Spanish language checked, rechecked, checked again, and then checked one last time. And we caught errors every time, because I'm not a native Spanish speaker, and I do not claim to be, but I tried to be very careful. I mean, I had Spanish professors and people who had different dialects. It was like a lot. And then Spanish sensitivity readers, and then there's less French in it, so it was more kind of textbook, and that was a little easier, so I only had two people that I went through with that.
I was going to ask you about that, because you have Spanish in there.
Yeah.
Quite a bit. Is she fluent? Like, what's the story behind that? So there, you answered that question.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about the Mexican egg tradition. Have you ever done
it? Oh, with the rubbing the raw egg on you?
That was, have you ever done that?
I have not done that. But it was definitely, it popped up maybe two or three times when I was looking up different ways to rid your body of like spirit and stuff like that. So it was there with the glass of water under the bed, and obviously the holy water, and yeah. And a lot of Celia's abuelos are like my based on my grandparents, and they just, like, especially her grandfather was like very much like my grandfather. And then like the Virgin Mary holy water, like the action figure bottle.
That was it.
We had that. That's what that sat on my grandparents' dresser with the collection stubs from, you know, St. Dominic's Catholic Church in Miami. And it was like the glass top dresser with the holy water bottle. Yep. I'm not a practicing Catholic. I'm not religious at all. It's, yeah. You know, I'm a historian.
Same here. I'm fascinated with other cultures. Like, you know, living in Turkey, what's really funny is it was actually illegal to have a Bible in Turkey. And so I never purchased a Bible until I moved to Turkey. So Turkey forced me to buy a Bible because I was, I was being rebellious.
Yeah,
I still have it, and I still every now and then I refer to it. But my favorite book is the Oxford Book of Saints. That is, ooh, I love. Yeah. It has Saint George on the cover slaying the dragon. As far as my questions, let me double check. I've got all my questions here. Is there anything that you would like to share specifically about the book that we haven't talked about?
I think basically just it's. It was a kind of a passion project. It was a book that I wrote easily, you know, apart from, you know, having to go back and like make sure that everything was double checked and, you know, fine and not harmful. But I wrote the book easily because it came from the heart. So I wrote it as a passion project, and I queried it for a little bit, but decided that ultimately, especially with what I went through with my fantasy series, we talked about that. It was a rough go, and I finally have my rights back to that. So I'm re-releasing that series, starting with Another Beast Skin in September. And then the third book will be out later on in the fall. But so Stars Like Gasoline, it was almost like a trauma response where I wanted to do it on my own to show that I could do it and do it properly. And I'm happy with it. You know, I think it turned out really well. And I think that's kind of it. It's just that it's something that was born of like my heart and soul. And it just, it needs a little bit more love. It needs a little bit more exposure.
That's what we're here for. We're going to wrap it up. But before we wrap it up, I'd love for you to take us out with the tagline, which of course I know you've heard before. You've said it before. And so I'm going to ask you to say it again. So if you would, Jessica, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for hanging out. Thank you for talking about your passion project. I feel very special to be able to talk about it with you. Mm-hmm. And especially because of that magical realism, and especially the way that you described it. So thank you for that. And so if you would please take us out with the tagline, go forth and be magical.
Thank you for having me. I always love having a chat, and go forth and be magical.